Shortly after coming to Dublin in 1649, at the beginning of the Irish campaign, Oliver Cromwell, the commander of the Parliamentary Army, issued a proclamation regarding civilians, or the country people, as he called them. Quote, "I do hereby warn all officers, soldiers, and others under my command not to do any wrong or violence towards country people or persons whatsoever, unless they be actually in arms or office with the enemy, as they shall answer to the contrary at their utmost peril." Now, the extent to which that proclamation was observed and has been the stuff of legend as well as historical debate ever since. But that Cromwell, a devout Christian of Puritan convictions, was leading an army in fighting for what he considered a just cause, tells us something about the attitude of the Puritans to war. Not only so, but that there were to be restraints in the fighting of a war tells us even more about how he and others like him thought about the justice of war. How did Oliver Cromwell and other Puritans come to this understanding of war? The question of when a war is a just war is one that Christians have been asking and trying to answer for centuries before the 17th century, and have continued to ask and try to answer ever since. The starting point for Protestants, and for Protestants, the supreme authority on the issue has been the Bible. And while the New Testament doesn't directly address these issues, it, together with the Old Testament, has provided Christians with the material with which they try to discern God's mind on this matter. However, Christians have come to differing answers to the question. There have been those who say that no war is a just war, and that Christians should never, under any conditions, fight and won. Quakers, all around us. And this is broadly the pacifist tradition of thinking of war, on war, that has been a minority position throughout much, if not all, of church history. And within this tradition, there are considerable variations. The majority position has been the just war tradition, within which there are also considerable variations. And which of these positions is biblical is something that every Christian has to decide from the Bible, before God, and in the company of his people, past and present. And that it is important to do so is something that hardly needs to be said. Like Christians in every age, the particular circumstances of our time shapes the way we think about war. Since the end of the Cold War, and even more since the terrible events of 9/11, there has been renewed interest in just war thinking. The Islamic doctrine of jihad that has been used to justify terrorism by some Muslims has put the theological issue of war and violence at the center of public debate. It's easy for Christians to dismiss this as a Muslim problem, but there is a tradition of holy war, or something approximating it, not only in our broader Christian past, the Crusades, for example, but in our Reformed and Puritan Christian past. As Christians, we need to examine this today not merely as an historical curiosity, but in order to understand why we don't advocate war in the name of God today. But there are also the broader issues of warfare. The end of the Cold War has, at least temporarily, diminished the threat of nuclear war, although, as we know, that threat is reappearing in another form as an increasing number of nations, Iran mentioned in Errol's prayer, want to develop nuclear weapons. And, of course, just today, the government's announcing its plans with the Trident weapons and so on. So, again, nuclear warfare is still very much an issue. But as the wars in the Balkans and more recent ones in the Middle East and Afghanistan, as well as other conflicts in various parts of the world have shown, conventional warfare is very much a practical reality. And it is important that in such a context we reflect as Christians on the justice of war. And this is not an exercise in abstract theologizing. Christians and churches have votes to cast, and they have to decide whether or not to fight in a war. There are Christians in the military that need wisdom in fulfilling their calling. And there is the broader Christian influence on public policy in relation to war. Now, this may not be as critical in the United Kingdom at present, but in the United States, where evangelical Christianity is much more influential, and in many developing countries where evangelicals are often in positions of power, the issues the Puritans had to face are still relevant. Today, we can learn both from their mistakes, but also from their insights. Now, in this paper, I want to focus on how the just war tradition has been understood and appropriated by most Reformed Christians. And I know that there have been and are some Reformed Christians who are pacifists, but the majority have not been and are not. And because of the particular concern of this conference, I will focus mainly upon how the Puritans understood and appropriated the just war tradition. And to that end, I will use one eminent Puritan, William Googe, as a kind of lens to help us see how the Puritans understood and appropriated the just war tradition. And in doing so, I trust that we will gain a deeper understanding of our own tradition in this vital area of ethical thinking and practice. However, as we begin, it would be helpful to remind ourselves of the Puritan consensus on the justice of war, as stated in the Presbyterian Westminster Confession of Faith, and adapted and included in the Congregationalist Savoy Declaration and the Baptist Second Londoner 1689 Confession. All three agree in regard to magistrates that, quote, God has armed them with the power of the sword for the defense and encouragement of them that are good and for the punishment of evildoers. The Westminster and Savoy then say in the next article, and it's on their outline, it is lawful for Christians to accept and execute the office of a magistrate when called thereunto, and the managing that whereof, as they ought especially to maintain piety, justice, and peace, according to the wholesome laws of each commonwealth, so for that end they may lawfully now under the New Testament wage war upon just and necessary occasion. The 1689 Confession has almost the same article but omits the word piety as one of the things the magistrate is to maintain. And that is significant in understanding the purposes for which war can be fought, as we will see. Certainly, what is included in other articles in the Westminster and Savoy and what is not included in 1689 reveal considerable differences as to the role of the magistrate. The Westminster and Savoy expand the role of the magistrate and by implication the use of force to protect the church and to promote true religion. But the Savoy prohibits the magistrate from curtailing the liberty of Christians who disagree on non-essentials of the faith, and the 1689 does not mention anything about the magistrate's role in either defending or promoting true religion. The question is then, what constitutes a lawful war? With that in mind, let's turn and consider how the Puritans arrived at their position on just war, how they understood and practiced it, and how it was developed, and how it has developed since then. So first of all, the just war tradition that the Puritans inherited from Augustine and his spiritual heirs. The Puritans, certainly the mainstream ones, were not fundamentalists in the sense that they read only their Bibles and nothing else in their desire to reform the church. They were consciously part of a long theological tradition that they valued and consulted. And it's interesting how that theme has seemed to recur several times in the conference so far. Not everything in that tradition was gold or even silver by any means. But in relation to war, as to many things, there was much wisdom that they could gain for their own understanding and practice. The church father that they most valued was Augustine of Hippo, 354 to 430. Augustine was the first theologian to formulate a coherent understanding of just war. In this, his mentor, Ambrose, the Bishop of Milan, had anticipated him with his positive view of the military, understandable since he had been a general in the imperial army. But that in itself shows how Christian attitudes to war and the military had changed. The testimony of the church in its first three centuries or so is somewhat ambiguous in relation to the justice of war. As members of a minority religion within the Roman Empire, Christians by and large did not have opportunity or inclination to fight in wars. Much that was associated with the imperial army, its inherent paganism, and the debauched nature of military life would have put Christians off. Christians accepted that they were to submit to the state as instituted by God and recognize its authority to uphold justice in line with Paul's teaching in Romans 13. But the teaching of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount and elsewhere, and its echo in Paul's teaching in Romans itself, the second part of Romans 12, first part of Romans 13 as well, seemed to some at least, to prohibit his disciples from engaging in warfare. But it is difficult to discern whether the issue for the church was war itself or its imperial and pagan associations. And in any case, it was not a pressing issue until the 4th century, when Christians had grown significantly in numbers and had received some official recognition by the empire. Now, Augustine wrestled with how to reconcile the traditional Christian understanding of passive submission to the state and the practice of nonviolence with responsibility now to defend the empire. The fallen nature of man and corrupted nature of society meant that war was a reality. He taught that it was justified to engage in war in certain circumstances and with restraint. His criteria for a just war, which he adapted from Cicero, was threefold: a just cause, legitimate authority, and a right intention. But Augustine's concern was not simply to create a legalistic framework that would legitimize warfare. His detractors often demonize him as trying to give a theological justification for the compromises of an increasingly powerful Christianity. But Augustine hated war, and he knew it was rarely fought in a just way. But strikingly, he believed that it was love that drove Christians to engage in warfare if necessary. He used the image of a brigand violently robbing or attacking and robbing a man. What does love compel us to do in such a situation? Well, if necessary, we must use force to rescue the victim. And so it is with war when the innocent are being attacked by a violent aggressor. The world is the way it is because man's love for God has been replaced with self-love that often ends in violence and war. Love demands that justice be pursued, even if that means using armed force. And of course, this is in part what Paul meant in Romans 13 by the word sword. Now, the important thing to remember about Augustine and the just war tradition to which the Puritans were heirs is that he had a deep sense of the tragedy of war. He had no illusions about the evil of war or sought to glamorize it, as many just warriors have done since then. Listen to him in his City of God. He's just pointed out that the Roman Empire was built through wars, all of which were claimed to be just, and most of which resulted in much cruelty. He says, consider the scale of those wars. With all that slaughter of human beings, all the human blood that was shed. And then he goes on and says, but the wise man will wage just wars. Surely if he remembers that he is a human being, he will rather lament the fact that he is faced with the necessity of waging just wars. For if they are not just, he would not have to engage in them. And consequently, there would be no wars for a wise man. For it is the injustice of the opposing side that lays on the wise man the duty of waging wars. And this injustice is assuredly to be deplored by a human being, since it is the injustice of human beings, even though no necessity of war arises from it. And so everyone who reflects with sorrow on such grievous evils, in all their horror and cruelty, will acknowledge the misery of them. And it's with this tragic sense of life in a fallen world and a heavy heart that a ruler engages in war. His intention must not be personal glory or gain, but the restoration of justice and peace in society. Only in this way could personal and social life flourish and true religion prosper. For Augustine, it was right that citizens of the heavenly city, can join in such wars in defense of justice and peace. Well, after Augustine, just war thinking was developed by theologians and canon lawyers. The Crusades of the 11th and 13th centuries raised the specter of holy war, but interestingly, the idea did not seem to figure in theological reflection on war. The most prominent theologian to think about war in the medieval period was Thomas Aquinas, who built upon and systematized Augustine's thinking in his Summa Theologica. And like Augustine, Aquinas believed that it was the duty of the sovereign to ensure just order and peace within his realm, and to that end, war was sometimes necessary. So Aquinas writes, in order that a war be just, three things are necessary. First, the authority of the sovereign by whose command the war is waged, for it is not the business of a private individual to declare war, because he can seek for redress of his rights from the tribunal of his superior. However, moreover, it is not the business of a private individual to summon together the people, which is to be done in wartime. And as the care of the common weal is committed to those who are in authority, it is their business to watch over the common weal of the city, kingdom or province subject to them. And just as it is lawful for them to have recourse to the sword in defending the common weal against internal disturbances, the police force, For example, when they punish evildoers, according to the words of the apostle, Romans 13, verse 4, so too, it is their business to have recourse to the sword in defending the common weal against external enemies. And secondly, a just cause is required, namely that those who are attacked should be attacked because they deserve it on account of some fault. And thirdly, it is necessary that the belligerents should have a rightful intention, so that they intend the advancement of good and avoidance of evil. Now, these three criteria derived from Augustine and generally accepted by Christians are the three primary criteria for a just war in the consensual tradition. They are not explicitly biblical, but from Aquinas' citation of Paul, we can see their biblical roots. Earlier, in the same section of the Summa, Aquinas deals with the objection that war is always sinful because of Jesus' teaching not to resist evil, Matthew 5, verse 9, and Paul's teaching not to take revenge, Romans 12, verse 19. And his answer is simply to cite John the Baptist's counsel to soldiers in Luke 3, verse 14, which did not include giving up soldiering. Now, it may seem strange to some that Aquinas was part of the tradition that the Puritans inherited, but he was. While not as influential as the canon lawyers in his own time, Aquinas' thinking was formative in the longer term on the developing just war tradition in the church. Aquinas' influence was probably most influential to the Puritans and Scots such as Samuel Rutherford through the writings of the Spanish Jesuit theologian Francisco Suarez, 1548 to 1616, who along with Francisco Molino and Francisco Vitoria, they seem like the name Francisco wrote extensively about war. Now, Suarez was not a slavish disciple of Aquinas and departed from him and developed his thinking on a number of points. In relation to just war theory, he opposed the theory of the divine right of kings, so much loved by Stuart monarchs. In fact, James I had Suarez's Defensio Fidei Catholicae of 1613 burned on the steps of St. Paul's Cathedral, not so much for its defense of the Catholic faith, but because of its attack on the divine right of kings. Needless to say, the Puritans loved it for that reason. And in addition to that work and to De Ligibus, 1612, Suarez said that political authority originated with the people themselves and not with the king, and that the state was based on a social contract between the ruler and the governed. You can see the influence that had on Samuel Rutherford. And as we will see, these ideas became prominent among the Puritans. Incidentally, Suarez also defended the right of the native population of the Americas against the policies of Spanish colonizers, and said they had their own rights and could fight just wars against the Spanish who were attacking them in as they were moving into what is today South America. It's a very interesting theologian. When we come to the Reformation, we find the magisterial reformers accepted the just war tradition as it has developed over the previous centuries, but adapted it in some significant ways. The Anabaptists, of course, did not do so, but in line with some pacifist renewal movements in the medieval church and what was thought to be the pacifism of the early church, developed a different tradition that is today followed by the so-called peace churches. I won't let the building shake just yet. Martin Luther did not question the right of the ruler to engage in war, and during the Peasants' Revolt used characteristically colorful language to make the point. But Luther's primary concern was pastoral. He wrote for the Protestant princes and magistrates who sought his counsel for the ordinary soldiers who had to fight in a time of great political turmoil. So in Temporal Authority, to what extent should it be obeyed, 1523, Luther wrote that a ruler, quote, must take care to deal justly with evildoers, unquote, which meant using the sword. However, he must do so with restraint and not for self-glory. Quote, he is a mighty poor Christian who for the sake of a single castle would put the whole land in jeopardy. Let this be the rule, where wrong cannot be punished without greater wrong, there let him waive his right, however just that may be. But if war is necessary, then Christians may fight with good consciences. Quote, in a war of this sort, it is both Christian and an act of love to kill the enemy without hesitation, to plunder, to burn, and to injure him by every method of warfare, until he is conquered, except that one must be aware of sin and not violate wives and virgins, unquote. Well, such warfare was an act of love, as he explains, echoing Augustine in whether soldiers too can be saved, 1526. It was an issue for these people. Could a soldier fighting in a war be saved? Could they be good Christians? And Luther is a pastor dealing with this issue. This is what he says. Now, slaying and robbing may not seem to be works of love. A simple man, therefore, does not think it is a Christian thing to do. In truth, however, even this is a work of love. In the same way, when I think of a soldier fulfilling his office by punishing the wicked and creating so much misery, it seems an unchristian work, completely contrary to Christian love. But when I think of how it protects the good and keeps and preserves wife and child, house and farm, property, honor and peace, then I see how precious and godly this work is. And I observe that it amputates a leg or a hand so that the whole body may not perish. For if the sword were not a guard to preserve peace, everything in the world would be ruined because of lack of peace. This is why God honors the sword so highly that he ordains it. Romans 13, verse 1. For the hand that wields the sword and kills with it is not man's hand, but God's. Nor is it man, but God who hangs, tortures, beheads, kills, and fights. All these are God's works and judgments. Very vividly said, but that's what the sword means to Luther. But Luther did adapt the just war tradition in the context of the conflict with Rome. His writings on war rejected the Roman Catholic doctrine that the church was the source of all earthly authority and defended the legitimacy of temporal government in its own right before God. He also recognized the work of rulers, magistrates, and soldiers as legitimate and godly callings. And very significantly, he rejected the idea of holy war. The Muslim Ottoman Empire was seen as the great enemy of Christendom, especially since the fall of Constantinople in 1453. And the papacy urged war against the Turks. But Luther agreed that war needed to be waged against the Turks, but not because they were Muslims, but because they were aggressive and threatened peace and order. So in On the War Against the Turk, 1529, he wrote, "The papacy undertook the fight against the Turk in the name of Christ and taught and incited men to do this, as though our people were an army of Christians against the Turks, who are enemies of Christ. This is absolutely contrary to Christ's doctrine and name." Now, Luther had no illusions about Islam, and he catalogs them in this book. But the sword was not the means to defeat it, even if it was the means to defeat the Ottoman Empire as a secular power. Now, with John Calvin, we have a more judicious and systematic approach to war, as one would expect. We don't have the vivid language of Luther. Like Luther, Calvin could not avoid interaction with politics, especially in his native France and in his adopted home in Geneva. Working in a context in which the church and state were inseparable and sometimes almost identical, Calvin also appropriated the just war tradition and adapted it. His own view is explained clearly in the 1559 edition of his Institutes of the Christian Religion. Man lives under both spiritual and civil governments. These two governments are not antithetical and should work together for God's glory and man's good. As for civil government, he writes that it has, quote, "as its appointed end, so long as we live among men, to cherish and to protect the outward worship of God, to defend sound doctrine and piety in the position of the church, to adjust our life to the society of men, to form our social behavior in civil righteousness, and to reconcile us with one another, and to promote general peace and tranquility." The question is how magistrates are to maintain this just and peaceful society with the sword when Christians are seemingly forbidden to kill. Calvin answers by saying that in administering punishments, the magistrate, quote, "does nothing by himself, but carries out the very judgments of God," unquote. And here he cites a number of relevant texts from both the Old and New Testaments. And it's in this context that Calvin then discusses war. "But kings and people must sometimes take up arms to execute public vengeance. On this basis, we may judge wars lawful, which are also undertaken. For if power has been given them to preserve the tranquility of their dominion, to restrain the seditious stirrings of men, to help those forcibly oppressed, to punish evil deeds, can they use it more opportunely than to check the fury of one who disturbs both the repose of private individuals and the common tranquility of all, who raises seditious tumults, and by whom violent oppressions and vile misdeeds are perpetrated? Indeed, if they rightly punish those robbers whose harmful acts have affected only a few, will they allow a whole country to be afflicted and devastated by it with robberies and with impunity? For if it makes no difference whether it be a king or the lowest of the common folk who invades a foreign country in which it has not a right and harries it as an enemy, all such must equally be considered robbers and punished accordingly. And therefore, both natural equity and the nature of the office dictate that princes must be armed not only to restrain the misdeeds of private individuals by judicial punishments, but also to defend by war the dominions entrusted to their safekeeping, if at any time they are under enemy attack. And the Holy Spirit declares such wars to be lawful by many testimonies of Scripture. However, there must be restraint in war. Magistrates are to guard against giving vent to their passions, and they're not to be, quote, carried away with headlong anger, or seized with hatred, or borne with implacable severity. They must certainly go to war only if necessary, and because there was no other recourse than to resort to war. Not only must there be restraint, but there must also be humanity in war when dealing with the enemy. Now, where Calvin adapted just war theory was in relation to unjust magistrates. The issue was particularly acute in France, where Protestants were being persecuted, but where also many of their leaders were in positions of power. And very cautiously, Calvin allowed for the possibility of resistance to a tyrant by lesser magistrates. Generally, Christians are to passively submit themselves to the governing authority and to accept tyranny as a judgment of God on the church or nation. But in exceptional circumstances, God has, quote, raised up open avengers from among his servants and arms them with his command to punish the wicked government and deliver his people, oppressed in unjust ways from miserable calamity. He cites Moses in Egypt and Othniel in the book of Judges as examples. And later he writes, after again explaining that Christians must submit to tyrants, he says, I am speaking all the while of private individuals. But if there are now any magistrates of the people appointed to restrain the willfulness of kings, as in ancient times the ephors were set against the Spartan kings, or the tribunes of the people against the Roman consuls, or the demarchs of the Senate of the Athenians, and perhaps as things are, such power as the three estates exercise in every realm when they hold their chief assemblies, I am far from forbidding them to withstand, in accordance with their duty, the fierce licentiousness of kings, because they dishonestly betray the freedom of the people, of which they know they have been appointed protectors by God's ordinance. Calvin's thinking here was immensely influential. His successor, Theodore Beza, developed this idea of resistance, as did French Protestant thinkers such as François Haussmann and Philippe de Mornay, whose writings were translated and read in England. In sections 30 and 31 of Book 20 of Book sections 30 and 31 of chapter 20 of book 4 of the Institutes were the seeds of revolution that would transform the political life of the English-speaking world for centuries to come. And we're still living with that legacy. So let's come on and consider the just war tradition that the Puritans taught and practiced in the turmoil of 17th century England. Like the reformers, the Puritans in England accepted the consensual just war tradition, but also like them, or at least some of them, adapted and developed it further. An exception to this, again, was the Quakers, who, like the Continental Anabaptists, dissented from the majority of Protestants in relation to war, as they did to many things. Now, the main period of Puritan activity and influence before 1660 was one of immense religious, social, and political turmoil. Much of this is reflected in different ways in the writings of the Puritans. They did not write abstract doctrinal and devotional works that bore little relation to their context. Their practical works are testimonies to their understanding of the world of their readers and the people in their congregations. Not only so, but the Puritans were deeply engaged, directly or indirectly, with the political life of the nation. And therefore, when it comes to the matter of war, we discover that the Puritans had much to say on this matter. There was no major treatment of the subject, but scattered through many writings, an understanding of just war is clearly discernible. Now, to help us navigate our way through this, I want us to focus on the just war thinking of one leading Puritan, that's William Googe, 1578 to 1653. Googe was born into a relatively wealthy merchant family in Stratford in Middlesex, which is East London today, where the Olympics will be. After attending St. Paul's and Eton College, he studied at Cambridge, where after graduation he lectured in philosophy, logic, and Hebrew. Through his mother, he was related by blood and law to other Puritan leaders. Her brothers, or his uncles, were Samuel and Ezekiel Coverwell, and her sisters were married respectively to William Whittaker and to Lawrence Chatterton, the well-known master of Emmanuel College, that sort of nursery of Puritan leadership. Googe married in 1604, and 4 years later, in 1608, became a lecturer at St. Anne's Church in Blackfriars in London, becoming rector in 1621. Known as the Arch-Puritan, Googe, over the next 35 years, built a strong congregation through his preaching and pastoral work and was a leading minister in the city. He was a strong advocate of Presbyterianism in church government and supported the covenant. He was not particularly active in politics, but he did support the parliamentary cause. However, he also supported the monarchy in principle, and he disapproved strongly of the execution of Charles I. He was a member of the Westminster Assembly and attended its sessions faithfully, serving on the committee for the examination of ministers and as an assessor and as a prolocutor. He died in 1653. Now, Googe wrote a number of books, the most famous being his commentary on Hebrews, which he almost finished just before he died. He also wrote a book on the Christian life as warfare, entitled The Whole Armor of God. It's interesting to note the number of books on this theme in this period. One thinks of John Preston's Breastplate of Faith and Love, William Gurnall's Complete Armor of God, John Bunyan's A Holy War, to name just three of the best-known works. It was a very common theme in literature. The metaphor of the Christian life as a war resonated with people and seemed to reflect something of the cultural atmosphere of strife, conflict, and war. Googe also wrote a practical guide to Christian living in the home entitled Domestical Duties. In addition, a number of his sermons were published, and it's from this that we can gather his understanding of war. Now, in the early 17th century, there was a significant change in the way armies were formed and fought. The conscript Swedish army of its Protestant king, Gustavus Adolphus, with its successes during the 30 Years' War in Poland, Germany, and elsewhere, was a new kind of army, just as later Cromwell's new model army would be. These were citizen armies, and its soldiers had a new dignity. Googe's sermon before the Artillery Company of London in June 1626 is a good example of the very positive attitude Puritans in this context had towards the military, as well as their pastoral concerns for soldiers. Published under the title The Dignity of Chivalry, Googe took as his text 2 Chronicles chapter 8, verse 9, in which we are told that the Israelites did not serve as servants under Solomon, but, quote, they were men of war, the chief of his captains, and captains of his chariots and horsemen. Googe spoke of how the artillery profession is honorable and cited many biblical and historical examples of soldiers. And in particular, he sought to encourage young men to volunteer as soldiers. And then he makes this remarkable statement. The death of the saints is precious in the sight of the Lord. But in war, so much more precious it is. By how much more glorious. Get faith, therefore, and a good conscience. Get them and keep them. And they will put life and spirit and virtue and valor into you. And they will make you fit for the artillery profession. And they will make you men indeed, true military men of mighty minds. Now, Googe, what you see here, was appropriating the older knightly concept of chivalry that applied to knights and the aristocracy and so on, and applying it to ordinary citizens and soldiers. They were to They, as soldiers, could display this kind of chivalry. They have the same dignity as medieval knights. Other Puritans spoke to the same purpose. Many ministers preached to artillery companies and later served as chaplains in the parliamentary army. Others wrote books. Alexander Leighton, the father of Bishop Robert Leighton, wrote The Looking Glass of Holy War, 1624, in which he spoke of the virtue of being a soldier and the necessity of godliness as well as mental and physical fitness. Richard Bernard, in The Bible Battles, 1629, wrote of soldiering as a virtuously valorous calling and employment, and went into great detail as to how such a calling could be fulfilled. Because the military was an honorable and even godly profession, ministers sought to give pastoral direction to soldiers. And so in his Christian Directory, Richard Baxter recognized the honorable calling of soldiers, although he thought it unlikely that many of them would be reading the book. Nevertheless, he sought to help them face the difficult decisions of military life, especially of having to decide whether or not a war was just. He wrote, quote, "When you are doubtful whether your call and cause be good, it is ordinarily safest to sit still and not venture into so dangerous a case without great deliberation and sufficient evidence to satisfy your conscience." Now, like Augustine and Luther before him, William Googe had no illusions about the nature of war itself. In The Arrows of God, 1631, he considered war, along with famine and plague, one of the three great evils God permits in a society. He wrote that the iniquity of man causes a necessity of war. And he went on to describe the evils of war, even when justified. Among other things, he mentioned treasure exhausted, men separated from families, trade disrupted, towns and villages destroyed, mourning for those killed, soldiers taken captive, bloodshed, atrocities, and interestingly, damage to nature. No true Christian can or may delight in war, Googe writes. He may in just cause wage war, but there is a great difference between doing a thing and delight therein, unquote. And Googe was not alone. Richard Bernard wrote that, quote, "The calamities and miseries of war are unutterable. Even if a war is just, if also necessary, is to be preferred before an unjust peace." And Alexander Leighton could write that war is the fruit of sin, the wages of sin, and the cause of sin. Yea, even one part of sin itself. In war, renown and honor and wealth and chastity and life and wives and children, yea, and religion itself lies at the stake. Nothing so sacred, no sex so tender, no age so impotent, which the barbarous soldier will not contaminate, deflower, and kill. Nevertheless, these men, and others like them, believed that in spite of the horror and evil of war, it was sometimes necessary. In the fury of war, a sermon preached in 1643 before the House of Commons after news was received of the atrocities against Protestants in Ireland. They might have been exaggerated, but the news was received and people were quite provoked by them. John Lay said, "For though war itself be a grievous calamity, yet if the enemy be not courageously resisted, and in his own way of violence, a worse thing than war will follow upon it, and that is perpetual tyranny and slavery upon the consciences and persons of the vanquished." Well, if war, in spite of its horror, could be fought in a just cause, as most Puritans believe, the question was, or is, what are the criteria for a just war? Now, no Puritan, as I've said, wrote a definitive treatise on the subject. But the relevant section in Googe's God's Three Arrows is perhaps the nearest thing. And here we find Googe drawing upon the Augustinian just war tradition. He begins to build his case that war is warrantable for Christians from the Old Testament by listing the examples of war being God's will, the faith of warriors commended in Hebrews chapter 11, God fighting for his people, the involvement of priests in war, the promises of victory for his people, not least the description of God as a man of war. Against the objection, no doubt coming from Quakers and others, that the Old Testament is irrelevant on this point, Gooch points out that the Old Testament is as truly divine as the New, and that it contains many things that concern the church to the end of the world. The nature of the New Testament is to be sparing in its teaching, where the Old was more plentiful, not only in regard to war, but also in regard to the Sabbath, usury, the removing of landmarks, and so on, he says. The purpose of the New Testament is to, quote, set out the spiritual kingdom of Christ and the spiritual government of his church, rather than, quote, civil outward polities and kingdoms of men. And therefore, it is more sparing on the subject of war, unquote. Moreover, the church in New Testament times, quote, had no outward settled state, but was under civil government, as were of a contrary persuasion, as heathen emperors and lords, unquote. Nevertheless, the New Testament does implicitly warrant war. And here, Gooch cites the example of the soldiers in Luke 3:14, who came to John the Baptist, the centurions in the Gospels and Acts, the warriors commended in Hebrews 11, the war of Michael in Revelation 12, and the victory of Christ over his enemies foretold in Revelation. But most important was Romans 13, verse 4, where Paul says that the governing authority beareth not the sword in vain. The magistrate's sword is justified, but he bears a sword as well to subdue open enemies abroad as to punish civil subjects at home. With that public sword, when he flays the malefactor, he is not to be accounted a flayer of men, but a destroyer of evil men, and Christ's avenger of those who do evil, and a protector of Christians. Having dealt with a number of objections to this position, Gooch then moves on to examine the criteria of a just war. And here he makes a distinction between extraordinary and ordinary wars. Extraordinary wars were those directly commanded by God, as was the case with Moses and Joshua. Anyone claiming to fight such a war, quote, must show a like warrant, which I assume he thinks no one could show. An ordinary war is one that can be legitimately fought today, either defensively or offensively. And for such a war to be just, there must be a just cause. Gooch writes, defensive war is that which is undertaken to defend ourselves or friends from such wrongs as enemies attempt against us or them, whether the enemies be foreign or domestic. No question can be made of the lawfulness of such wars as these. Necessity forces men thereto. Offensive wars are when enemies are first set upon, which, according to the causes given of offending the enemy, may be as just as defensive war. And what are just causes? Well, Gooch lists with biblical illustrations the maintenance of the truth and purity of religion, recovery of that which is unjustly taken away, execution of such as have done public wrong, drawing away enemies from some dangerous plot that they have in hand, weakening the power of open and professed enemies, subduing of the rebellious subjects that gather head and will not be brought under law, and to help and to assist friends and allies in like cases. But even with a just cause, a war was only just if, secondly, it was sanctioned by lawful authority. Gooch has already mentioned this in connection with Romans 13, verse 4. But he also stresses that law is not to be undertaken by a private person for revenge. Rather, war is, quote, a kind of execution of public justice and a means of maintaining right. Christ forbids private revenge, no matter how justified. When a war is sanctioned by lawful authority, then, if commanded to go to war, it is necessary to do so. But the sanction of war by lawful authority was itself limited by a third criterion, and that of right intention. There must not be, says Gooch, any notion of unreasonable passion or anger, or ambition or vainglory, or desire for earthly possession whatsoever. And to these three classic criteria for a just war, Gooch adds, as many others have before him and since, the criteria of last resort. Before going to war, quote, all good and fair means be used to move enemies voluntarily to do what is just and equal. Now, other writers have mentioned the same criteria of war. Richard Bernard spoke of how a war is just by reason of instinct of nature, of custom of nation, by religion, that's undertaken for the defense of a country, religion, and of the state. John Lay, in a sermon preached that I mentioned a bit earlier, mentioned six criteria: lawful authority, a just cause, a good intention, proportionality, that is, as the end must be good, so must be the means by which the end is achieved, and last resort. And in his sixth one is that when the war is ended, there should be no warlike enmity. And the influential independent theologian William Ames writes that war by itself, nakedly and entirely considered, is a kind of evil. Nevertheless, it is not always unlawful, but it may be warranted upon some conditions, which he lists as just cause, just authority, right intention, and the right manner of waging war. I realize I'm going over time at this point. Is that right? Okay. You bear with me? Yep, okay. Just might try to skip a few things here. Okay. Well, attention has, I've already mentioned that attention has also was also paid to the just conduct of war. And Richard Bernard, for example, went into considerable detail in his book, The Bible Battles, perhaps one of the most influential books on the subject in this time, as to how a soldier should justly conduct himself in war. So in this outline here, you have criteria that are ad bellum, criteria that you bear in mind going into war, going towards war: sovereign authority, just cause, right intention, and so on. But they also paid attention to in bello criteria, that is, how is a war conducted justly? Proportionality, discrimination, that is, not targeting civilian populations, and respect for the enemy. And Richard Bernard did this in his book, The Bible Battles, and goes into great detail, if you read that, even how soldiers should march, how they should arm themselves, how they should shoot, how should they deal with their enemy when defeated, and so on. Likewise, Alexander Leighton, in The Looking Glass of Holy War, gave advice on many aspects of military life, noting that while godly soldiers must trust in God, no secondary means may be neglected, perhaps anticipating Cromwell's advice to praise God and keep your powder dry. He advised that war must be offensive as well as defensive, so that the enemy may gain the advantage and hurt and the enemy be hurt first. And it's interesting to note that how Leighton deals with the whole subject of spying, and with particular reference to the spy sent by Joshua to Jericho. He says that the spy, quote, may conceal the truth or some part of the truth, change his habit, make show of what he meaneth not to do, in all of which he must take heed that his lies be not in the matter of religion. So the spy can, in the case of war, legitimately lie, he says, for just cause. Such counsel may strike some as Protestant cosetry, but what these men were doing was engaging as Christians with the reality of fighting a just war. They would have been the first to recognize that in their conduct, few, if any, wars are wholly just. But that did not mean that if such wars were to be fought, that you have to think carefully about their conduct and about their ethics. Now, before the 1630s, the issue facing the Puritans regarding war was the Protestant cause on the continent. They were very much aware of the precarious position of many continental Protestants during what came to be known as the 30 Years' War. Many of the writings earlier in the century were directed towards encouraging James I and then his son Charles I to support the cause. So, for example, Richard Bernard dedicated his Bible Battles to both King Frederick of Bohemia and to Prince Charles. And he told the latter that, quote, our eyes are fixed towards you, and then upon you, you are the tree from whose shade the saints do look for shelter and refreshment, the saints being the continental reformed. But by the 1630s, Charles's rule was increasingly seen as tyrannical and in need of being resisted both politically and in the end militarily. Now, as far as we know, William Goodge was silent on this matter, but other writers were less so. Those who were not built upon the teaching that had originated with Calvin in Geneva. Earlier, Christopher Goodman, one of the Marian exiles, had articulated a theory of resistance to tyranny that went much further than what Calvin had taught and was closer to the teaching of Beza and to the French Huguenots. He justifies resistance and even armed resistance to a tyrant. But the next generation of Puritans were forced by events to develop the ideas of legitimate resistance to tyranny. The problem for the Puritans in their struggle in a just cause against Charles' tyrannical rule was that he was the lawful authority that could sanction war. So you'd have to have a just authority to go into war, but Charles was the just authority, but he was tyrannical. So could you act against, in a military way, the one who gave you authority? Well, there were several solutions to this problem. One solution was to see their struggle as against Charles's advisors and not against him as such. So in a sermon to volunteer soldiers in Norwich in 1642, William Bridge said that, quote, "There is much difference between taking up arms against the king's person and taking up arms for the defense of a kingdom without the king's command." And here he used David's attitude to Saul and his advisors as an example. And Jeremiah Burroughs said in a sermon before the House of Commons, quote, "Wherefore that which is now done is not against the king, though it be against the personal command of the king. Yet it is not against the legal power of the king. When we speak of a king, we mean such as a man invested with a regal power by the laws and constitutions of the country of which he's king." Now, if nothing is done against this power, then nothing can be said to be done against the king. But in the end, this just proved to be a fiction. Another solution was to see the king as ceasing to be king because of his tyranny, along the lines that Goodman and some of the French Huguenots were teaching. This view was argued most fully by the Scottish Presbyterian theologian Samuel Rutherford in Lex Rex, published in 1644 in order to influence Parliament against compromising in its negotiations with the king. Rutherford went much further than many English Presbyterians such as Googe would go. And as John Coffey points out, in justifying tyrannicide, he came very close to justifying regicide, with its imagery of the necessity of the body politic of, quote, "cutting off a contagious member that by a gangrene would corrupt the whole body," unquote. Now, Rutherford was horrified when Charles I was executed in 1649, and later said that Charles had not been a tyrant, but merely a lawful king acting tyrannically. But John Milton considered that hypocritical humbug. 5 minutes I have. Right. Okay, let me just go on to Holy War, okay? So the question then I just want to ask is this: did the Puritans teach and practice a form of holy war? Or put another way, could war be justified on grounds of defending or promoting the Christian religion? It's important to, it's difficult to, I think, to avoid the conclusion that they did. The causes of defending English liberties and that of true religion were so intertwined by most of the Puritans as to be almost indistinguishable. The language of the Bible, and especially the Old Testament, shaped their political rhetoric so that even if they were not actually advocating holy war, they sounded like they were. England was, in a sense, Israel, metaphorically, but perhaps almost literally, in that she was seen as a covenanted nation. The enemies of liberty and religion were seen as the Amalekites, the Assyrians, and the Babylonians, and other enemies of Israel. And especially as millenarian notions took hold, the opponents of the Puritans were by some seen as in league in some degree with the Antichrist. And since the Reformation, such language had been used of the papacy and its allies. But in the conflict with the king and his forces, it was increasingly applied to them. The evidence for this is almost too much to document. It's everywhere to be seen. Take William Googe, for an example. As we have seen, he believed that war was justified for the maintenance of truth and purity of religion. And he could write that wars ordered by God are instruments of his wrath and justice against his impenitent people. His sermons assumed the parliamentary cause was a holy one, with its easy linkage of Israel's struggles with that of the cause of Christ today. But Googe's rhetoric was mild compared to others. Alexander Leighton longed that, quote, "our camps may be holy camps, and our wars sanctified by the Lord." War could be, he said, grounded upon the absolute command of God for the revenging of him upon his enemies or the delivery of his people. Now, I won't quote them all, but there was a whole series of sermons that began in 1640 when different people such as Stephen Marshall, William Bridge, Thomas Wilson, Edward Calamy, and others preached before Parliament, and their language basically was that the cause of Parliament was the cause of God, and that they were taking up arms against the king in a holy war against God. Stephen Marshall, for example, in his sermon, which was preached 60 times. He preached it 60 times, called Meroz's Curse, in reference to Meroz in the book of Judges that came under Deborah's curse for not helping Israel, or helping her and Barak and others at the time of their conflict. Really basically said that this was a holy war that Parliament was involved in. Now, allowance must be made for the overheated political rhetoric of this period. But even so, there is a form of holy war being advocated. Such a concept of just war is implicit in the view that it is part of the magistrate's role to both defend and promote true religion. And since in the Puritan mind there was no fundamental distinction between the secular and the spiritual, there was no reason to see why the sword of the state could not be used for spiritual purposes. The reason for this was the close identification of the people of God under the new covenant, not only spiritually, but also in a sense politically, with the people of God under the old covenant. There was a hermeneutical issue here concerning the relationship of the old and new covenants. And added to this was the millenarianism that was shaping so much thinking. As many thought that they were experiencing or soon would experience much that was prophesied in the books of Daniel and Revelation, the militaristic imagery there resonated with their literal military concerns. Well, I'm going to stop that, just deal with the third section. But I basically think the Puritans handed on the just war tradition, but soon the holy war concept simply passed away, and it wasn't really perpetuated. But the main thrust of the just war tradition passed on, and it's what we have, in effect, inherited today. So just some challenges and applications. The first is that the just war tradition should drive us back to acquainting ourselves with what our political forebears have thought and taught in this area. Political ethics is not taken straight from the Bible. The Bible is the basis and framework of our thinking about ethics, but we gain much from learning from those who have gone before us and would be very unwise not to listen to them. Of course, they didn't get everything right, and the Puritans are not an exception. But they did try, as sinful mortals redeemed by grace, to grapple with the moral issues presented by the necessity of fighting just wars. The particular criteria of just war needs careful thought as to its application today. Take, for example, the present war in Iraq. It raises all sorts of questions about the criteria of sovereign authority to wage war, unilateralism or multilateralism, a just cause, weapons of mass destruction, tyranny of Saddam Hussein, right intention, spreading democracy, politics, perhaps oil, the last resort, were all the means of resolution pursued through the UN, other means? These are questions that need to be asked. It also raises the issue that even if justified, was it wise to fight this war? Personally, I'd argue that. Technically it was just war, but it might be a very unwise war. And can an enemy be attacked in self-defense before it attacks preemptive war? Then thirdly, the example of the Puritans and others should move us to engage in some serious moral reflection in our own generation. We face new challenges, and Reformed evangelicals have much to contribute. Part of the problem in the United Kingdom is that as evangelicals, we're on the margins of power, and that may not be a bad thing. However, it does make just war thinking sometimes seem remote and academic, whereas in the United States, for example, evangelicals are much closer to the center of political power and influence, perhaps too close. Nevertheless, we must still do some hard work here in what influence we have, we can make a valuable contribution. And fourthly, in this regard, we must remember that in much of the developing world, evangelical Christianity is growing rapidly, and it should have a very constructive influence on their societies. Now, the Puritans have much to teach people in the developing world, both negatively and positively, in situations where democracy and the rule of law are in the process of developing, just as they were in the 17th century. And the thinking they had to go through is something that's very relevant to many parts of the world today. Faced with dictators, presidents for life, and one-party rule, there is much to learn about how and how not to resist tyranny. Then fifthly, the Puritans did make their mistakes. And we must not be too hard on them, as they were men and women of their times and culture, just as we are of ours. Their biggest problem was an inadequate hermeneutic for interpreting the Bible, so that in this area, at least, they did not read their Bibles without reference to God's redemptive history and God's unfolding purpose for his people. The relationship between the Old and New Testaments is still one that we need to work on for our political ethics. The Puritans also warn us not to put our trust in princes or political developments. The sadly, as recent experience in the United States shows, that is a lesson that the people never seem to learn. Also, the issue of Islamic jihad, I think, raises the issue today of holy war. And we have to face the issue that there is this in our past, and I think we need to repudiate this idea of holy war so that we can repudiate it today. And then finally, the Puritan ministers were pastors, and we can learn much from them about the need to care for Christians involved in the military, as well as to guide Christians as citizens of the earthly city. At the heart of pastoral ministry is the gospel of grace. But as Paul reminded Titus, Christians must on that basis, in public as well as in private, learn to devote themselves to doing what is good. And in the end, this is where William Goodge is such a good example. He was a pastor whose great concern was to guide people through this world to the eternal city of God. Sadly, sometimes that pilgrimage involves living in times of political turmoil and strife and even war. Christians need instruction about how to live in a godly way as active citizens of the earthly city of man, but whose ultimate loyalty is to the eternal city of God, where there is peace and where in the new heaven and new earth there will be no war.